Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink Podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
All right, everyone. Good morning again. I'm Dani, compulsive overeater. I figured out my Zoom now. Very grateful to be here. I think the Kitchen Sink meeting was one of the first meetings I ever came to. It was the second meeting I ever came to. And I believe that was 1989. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I was, I always had probably an impulse to eat my feelings, if you were. But if we go way, way back, I was almost died when I was born. I was in the hospital for a year isolated. And I include that because I think it had something to do with like how I live the rest of my life, which is almost feeling isolated at all times. That's like my go-to way of being in the world, and then feeling terribly lonely, but like still feeling like outside. And so, you know, as it is in the literature about like terminal uniqueness, you know, that's kind of in my cells. I was raised in New York City with a mother who had been a model. So she was very, very focused on her appearance. And also there was always a diet. Everyone's always dieting. There's early pictures of me like grabbing my stomach. Like there's one weird picture and like I was just a normal kid, but I think that it was like a way to stay attached to my mother, to also be like her. And so then I just, you know, the greatest hits. So then, I'm very honest, by the way. So if you're not comfortable with that, I don't know what to tell you. Like I was molested when I was eight, and I was we left. We were living in New York City. We left, and then we moved to Connecticut, where I was like the Jew in Connecticut. Like it's kind of the greatest hits of like. It's the makings of a comedian. What can I say? All along there, I was pretty much hiding out with binge eating. I was a binge eater and then very self-conscious about my body, like, and always feeling kind of like an outsider for a multiple of reasons. And you can add, you know, chubby in the mix. Moved to a town in Connecticut that there weren't very many people like me at the time. And I was very conscious of that. And probably contributed to being like an overachiever. Like I have to be better than everyone. Since I'm not like everyone, I better be better than everyone. So I was like president of everything and hey, blah, blah, all that, captain and all those things. And very lonely. And my mother, God rest her soul, used to say, well, what can I tell you, Jani? It's lonely at the top. That was like her idea of compassion. So, So food was a real comfort for me. And it was also, there was this sense of like, eat, why aren't you eating? Why are you overweight? Like it was constant drama around body and food. And my sister was obese most of our lives. And that was a big topic of conversation. So I definitely got the message, if you want to be loved, you shouldn't be overweight. This lives with me to my demise to this day, which I can get to. I went off to college and decided that I was not going to be the fat smart girl. I was going to be something else. So I went on a really interesting there was an interesting program, which I don't know if I can say, it was like 40 years ago. But it was a food plan that actually started to talk about, like, how'd you write about what are you feeling when you eat? Like, it was very ahead of its time in that regard. And so I did start to have some connection to that. And then I went to college. I was like the pretty girl for like, you know, 3 months. And I thought it was really boring. So then I just started binging again. And, you know, kind of work. I was always kind of managing it through working out. And came to New York and to be an actress, because that's what we called it back then, and waited tables, led a super burnout life of like dance classes, waiting tables, audition, like just a real burnout lifestyle. And always conscious that I, very conscious of that I should be thinner. I have a constant tape in my head about being thinner. I did get into therapy at that point. I do have some resentment that I spent my waitressing money telling a therapist about my eating disorder. And like she never said, hey, you know what? You could probably go somewhere else to talk about this and get a spiritual life. But God bless her too. So then, okay, so what's really relevant is then about 35 years ago, I got a virus. It's going to be hard for me not to be emotional about this. I got this virus and they didn't know what it was. And I was waiting tables. Basically, my lifestyle was, contributed greatly to my being susceptible to this. But I ended up like not being able to walk or do anything for like 2 or 3 months. And nobody knew what it was. And it was the nicest my mother ever was to me. And anyway, eventually I healed, I think just through rest. I don't, nobody ever gave me medication. They tested my liver. There was something wrong with my liver. So I stopped drinking then. So that was the beginning of that whole journey. And I think my eating cleared up, but I don't, I just think I was young and it passed. And I came to LA with $500. I said, I got to get out of New York. I had $500. And I knew one person. I knew two people. I knew the person I was staying with in Brentwood. And I knew this woman, Barbara, which some of you may know Barbara. And I called her and I was living in one room and sleeping on a futon and eating popcorn. And that's really all I did. I ate popcorn and then I ate another bowl of popcorn. And then I waited for the phone to ring. And so one night, Barbara on a Friday said, she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm eating popcorn. And she said, okay, well, why don't you come with me to a meeting? It's called Overeaters Anonymous. I was like, that is probably not going to happen. I don't think I'm going to go to anything that sounds like my mother and a diet. So I don't think I'm going to go. And she said, okay, well, you don't have to go. Just meet me at the Figaro Cafe. Some of you old timers might know the Figaro Cafe. It was at the end of Melrose, and it was basically like an eating disorder mecca at 6 o'clock on Friday nights because there was a meeting at Fallon's at 8, I think. And so I went and I met her there, and I wouldn't eat anything. And then dinner was over, and she waved to everybody like she was mayor, like she knew everybody there. And she said, well, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm going to go home and stare at the wall and eat popcorn. And she said, well, why don't you just come with me? Like, this just come. So I went with her and I walked into the room at Thalian's, and there was like what appeared to be like 75 people there in a conference room with someone at a podium, a man at a podium talking about his spiritual life and his realization that there was an alternate universe where he could be honest about his behavior with food and feel connected and feel a part of something and not feel shame. And when they said, are there any newcomers? I went like this. I went to search my bag for something because I couldn't, I it was all just too much. It was all too like, it was like science fiction to me. And so I drove home, and then they had said there's a meeting the next morning. I think it was this meeting. I think it was 9 a.m. kitchen sink meeting on Robertson, just north of Melrose in that log cabin. And you could go to that if you want. So, of course, I mean, I do seek help. I am one of those kinds of people, even in my 20s. So I got in my car and I went. And again, there was like 100 people there. And this woman, very articulate, talking about her. How her struggle with food and body and perfectionism gave her a spiritual awakening, like brought her to this program, which gave her a spiritual awakening. And I just was like, oh, wow. Like, oh, these are my people. So that was remarkable. And I think 30 something years ago. And I've never left. I do this highly imperfectly. I got a sponsor right away. Worked steps. I had headshots done. I remember early on when I was early in program, and they looked like I had found the light. I looked like one of those stand up and cheer people who cross the country praising the Lord. Like I was so, there was such a light in my eyes, and I couldn't believe sponsorship. I couldn't believe that people would stay on the phone with you and not ask for money. Like I thought this whole thing was like crazy. It was so antithetical to the way I was raised. It just taught me so much immediately. And then life starts to happen, you know? Like I don't, I went through, I've gone through various no sugar abstinence, no, I do believe 3 meals a day, 2 snacks, life in between. I've worked through all the steps. I remember I've done several ninth step, but I remember, you know, there's the, well, I shouldn't get ahead for people who don't know. So there's like you make a there's making amends and taking an inventory, making amends, and I, you know, certainly one or two of my amends, they didn't go so well. What are you gonna do? Like you do the footwork. And you know, I had a roommate in New York, and he used to make casseroles, and I used to steal the carrots out of his casseroles. Like, you know, I was I don't think he was charmed by that ultimately, even when I apologized. So the you know, it's just been a rich life. I've been through at this point, I feel like I've been through just about everything, but I hesitate to say that because I don't want to bring on anything else. I met my husband. I was sober. Oh, interesting point though to make. So I was on the road, I believe, and my father was, oh yes, and my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I was fortunately, I had been brought to New York. So I had an apartment in New York when he got his diagnosis. So, and they said he had like 8 months to live or something. So I was able to be with him and show up for that completely. The night before he died, I was in my own bed, and I had made an abstinent dinner, and was by my answering machine phone when the phone rang at 5, and they said, "Your father has 2 hours to live." And I got dressed, and I showed up, and I was fully present for that moment. And I knew that that was an act of God, that I was pretty wild in those years, and that I was in my own bed and available, alone and available, and had an abstinent meal the night before, so that I wasn't hungover in any way. I was like, all right, well, so I guess I'm never leaving OA, because like I can't now, like I'm in, if to be able to have that experience. And my mother fainted, and like everything fell apart, and I was like fully there. And of course I had no idea what was coming next. Let's see. So I did ultimately meet someone. I never stayed with anyone for more than I think 4 months before I met my husband. And I met him, and he had a dead mother, and I was like, yes, okay, we have something in common, and I could talk about all real things. He loves the real things. And we've been together 22 years, almost 23 years. It's not an easy marriage. Many of you know I'm very vocal about that. I don't know. I show up. I get help when I need it. I talk about it, and I am ultimately grateful to have a partner. And I have 2 kids. So that's the other thing. I decided to have children very late. And I guess I don't mean to make this so much of a personal monologue, but I could not show up for anything without this program. That's really the point. I had children very late. I decided at 39 I should have a kid. I got pregnant very quickly. I was lucky. Then I had no idea how to be a mother, like none. Like I didn't even know any mothers. I was a comedian. I was like, what? You do what? And so I turned to people in this program. I knew to ask for help. Also, asking for help was not my thing. I was smarter and faster, and thank you very much. I got this. And what I learned here is I don't got this. And in my current set of circumstances, I really don't got this. I get to be reminded of that again. So all of the principles of this program of, find someone who has what you want and be willing to do the footwork, do whatever, do half and God meets you halfway. And I mean, there's so many of them that are true. So, okay, so then I had the first baby, and that was a complete miracle. And then I realized, oh, I really should have been doing this my whole life. Now I want another one. And I was 41. Okay, so then I went through fertility to ha I had a miscarriage. Then I went through fertility to have the second one. Again, I could not have shown up for any of that without the principles of this program and the people in these rooms, and knowing that you just take one day at a time, one minute at a time, and you turn it over to God and you pray for the next right action. And it's really, really important for me to hear this right now. And okay, so then I don't have that. I don't have much time. Okay, so then my mother got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So that's kind of been the most recent chapter of my life. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She was living in New York alone. I finally had to bring her out here. I brought her on a commercial airline flight with advanced Alzheimer's. It was high drama, but we did it. And I was able to move her out of New York against everybody's advice and bring her here to have sunshine and then ultimately have comedians. That's another story. And she died 4 years ago. It was a really tough relationship, and I miss her a lot. What are you going to do? Okay, so recently, I was in Argentina and I got COVID. And I was with my family and I refused to be sick because you can teach me a lot of things, but the nature of who I am is I am going to keep going and doing. And so I kept going and doing. And at this point, it's 6 weeks. I have not gotten rid of this. I don't. I've been to every healer and spent thousands of dollars now. And everyone keeps telling me you have to rest. I'm so not interested in resting. I don't like it. I think it feels lazy. It's just not my nature. And so I feel humbled, super duper humbled. And I'm super grateful for Zoom because I don't know what I would do if I were isolated and not able to connect with everyone daily, which I do. I try to get on the 7:30 meetings every day and try to get my head in the right place and hear about 1 minute at a time showing up. And the other, kind of maybe no accidents part of what I'm struggling with is very food related. So it's very, they toss this word inflammation around, and there's a lot of foods that trigger inflammation. So basically, I used to say I didn't eat sugar, but then I would sometimes because my whole final abstinence was no throwing up, no matter what. Like I'm just, I don't want to be a prisoner to a diet, but like those, I do have certain parameters. And now, if I eat sugar, I literally fall asleep. It's so bad for me. All of that. So anyway, I did end up having a second kid though, and he's very cute. And he ended up having to get sober at 14. Yes, and so that's a miracle. Because he had issues with marijuana, and as soon as he hit bottom, it was very clear. I was very clear where he needed to be, and he knew where to be. So he now has 2 years, and he goes to meetings, and he's a really special person, and I'm so grateful. And I'm so grateful that he's grateful. He loves his meeting, and that's a miracle. So, like I'm a lifer. I'm not going anywhere, and I'm not perfect, and That's another big lesson I've had to learn. I don't like not being perfect, but I do get to have a better life if I could be perfect all alone in a room eating popcorn. That was definitely where that was going. So I run a business, and I don't know what the future of the business is for today. I do not know. I know I will not make myself sick trying to keep it going, and there is a stress component to what's going on with me. So again, I have to keep checking in with God and asking, what's up, God? I remember, I'm going to close in 1 minute. I remember I was waiting tables for many years, and at the end of my waitressing career, I was crying in the bathroom, and I was already in program, and I was crying in the bathroom with chips, and I thought, God doesn't, there's got to be something else I can do to make money. Like, I can't, this isn't what God wants for me. And that hasn't changed. Like, I have to keep asking, what does God want for me? Because I know what I want for me. I want to run myself into the ground so that I have value in this world. But I don't think that's what God wants for me. I'm willing to believe that that's not what God wants for me. God wants for me to have love in my life and people in my life and maybe some joy once in a while and art and music and dance and healthy food and healthy people. So, and I learned everything here. I've been here more than half my life. And I mean, I will say it's the most important thing in my life. If I don't have this, I don't have anything else. So I'll close on that. Thank you. Thank you, Steve, for the opportunity to be here. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hand. If you have a question, please click the raise your hand icon. Okay, Bianca.
Hi, Danny. It's really good to see you. Thank you so much for your share. Could you talk about your conception and your relationship with your higher power?
Oh, that. It's something I have to work at, to be honest. Which I do, which I'm willing to do. I also, when they talk in the big book or some of the literature about, when it comes to religion, find the things that you have in common with religion rather than, and so I'm a member of like a religious temple now too, not religious, but a temple. But for me, it's I find my relationship with God much more in meditation, in being quiet with myself. And it is like this sense of love. What's the most loving way I can be? That to me is God's voice. And so I try to find that. And it's particularly challenging in my marriage because my voice is critical. So I have to say, okay, thank you, critical voice. How can I be most loving? What's the most loving thing I can do? Because I believe that that is where God is. And it's very hard, especially given current events, right? Like, how is there a God? And I've made a point to distinguish myself from my mother that way, who grew up in the Holocaust, that whole World War II situation. And so for her, there was no God. And I don't see that that really worked for her. And that is my experience. Like, I was very much an agnostic, I would say, in high school and probably college. It wasn't until I got sick that first time that I was like, okay, God, I get like what? I just felt leveled and I felt like I had to rely on something bigger than me. And at this point, I feel like having a relationship with God is a choice. It's a choice for me, and it makes my life better. And so I do feel, as I'm sure people have heard, it's a relationship. Like, you have to talk to God and you have to confer with God. and have God be a presence in your life if you want to have a relationship with God. If you want to feel that connection, you have to invest in it. So I think that's my answer. That's something. Okay. Ryan.
Thanks so much for your lead, Danny. That was amazing. So my question is, and I thought of it before I realized that it would be possibly tugging on your heartstrings, but how did your relationship with your mom change and grow after, you know, you got a handle and program? And, you know, whether that's how she was with you or how you had to just, you know, manage yourself around her and, you know, anything around that.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And as I said, it was a complicated relationship. So I was already in program, obviously, when my father died. And I was in New York and she was in New York. And it became very quickly, like within a month, that she was expecting me to be her second husband because I was single. And I knew I had to get out. I knew I had to get out. I couldn't. That wasn't going to be my life. And because I was in program and I had support and, you know, I left. Because I had a car out here already from when I'd been here before. And I just got on a plane and left. And then our relationship was really tough for a couple of years. So, but I had to save my life. I mean, I think if you're in this program, you're working this program, it's to save your life. Like, this isn't like, you know, a diet club. Like, you don't come here because you have a casual relationship with food and your body. Like, these are high stakes. And I knew that. And I knew if I stayed, I would die. And then I worked at being as generous as I could with her. And then when she really needed me, there was no question. There was no question. I made sure that she was taken care of and that, you know, and we had some laughs. And I had a different relationship with her as she lost her mind. We had a better relationship because she wasn't so mean. And I'm grateful. And that's because of what I learned here, because you keep showing up. So it's kind of magical, but it wasn't easy. It was a very long journey. And I don't have any regrets. I don't think. Some days I do now because I miss her. I wish I'd spent more time with her, but not really. Not if I had, because she wasn't nice. So, you know, it's complicated. I think these relationships are the parent ones, they're the big guns. And, you know, to the extent that you can find like unconditional love in these rooms, it helps to temper that need with your parents if they can't give that to you. So, bon chance. Yes, Beth.
Thank you so much, Danny, for your lead. yeah, just thank you so much. You talked about being critical. Can you talk a little bit about your character defects and how you worked on them?
Work on them.
Work on them.
I think awareness is the first step, right? So if you do the doing the fourth step, doing the fifth step, becoming, oh, these are my character defects. But I mean, I have to work on them like yesterday. Like, unfortunately or fortunately, because we also have character assets that are woven into the fabric of who we are. And, you know, we don't take a lot of time to like, but, you know, they don't necessarily leave you. You just become more aware of them. I had someone say to me yesterday, yet another one of the healers that I've been to, like when you hear the critical voice, you just say, oh, that's me being critical. Thank you. That's not useful right now. So I think I really do believe that if you can just be aware of it, you at least have hope of not acting out on it. You know, I have like an envy thing. I really think there are so many women that got the handbook that I didn't get. And then I can get into a whole trip about that. Like, why didn't I do that? I should have done that. Look at me. It's not helpful. So I can just say, okay, that's my mother, like to the nth degree, that was her whole life. And so I can hopefully on good days call it out. You're just, put that away. That's not helpful. It's not serving you. So you can put that one away. But I do think doing the work, doing the steps to identify what they are. And then also, you know, that idea of like a shadow and light to each of them, right? Like I'm envious, but I'm driven. You know, I'm driven. I want to create something else. I want to, you know, and yeah, I think there's shadow and light to them. So yeah, Jen.
Hi, thank you for sharing your story. Is your husband supportive of your recovery and your food plan?
Yeah, my husband, who I love to complain about, is amazingly supportive of everything that I do. I'm very lucky. And he ended up in program. We all ended up in program because of my son. So not for food, but yeah, it he is. And I mean, here's the thing. In this most recent iteration with the healers that I've gone to, we have fought about that. He's an intellect, loves to tell me all the statistics about acupuncture and the statistics about whatever. And I can't hear that right now. I don't care. If it helps me, that's all I care about. I don't care how many effing studies there are about placebo and all of it. I don't care. So I have to say, I thank you for sharing. I can't hear it right now. Go read a book. Go read a study. I'm not interested. So you can hear, even that's me being like somewhat nice. Like you can imagine how mean I can get, and I don't want to do that. But I do get, I'm so defensive about my health right now. So, but in every other aspect, anything, I'm very, very lucky. One time I remember after I had a baby, I sat down to eat, because what I learned here, you have to sit down to eat. You have to sit down, honor your meal. And there was a lot of chaos. And I was like, no, I'm going to sit. And when I'm done, I'm going to get up. And like, I still remember that. So obviously it was a boundary I had to draw for myself. So no drama, no anger, nothing. Just, this is what I need to be present and of service. This is what I need. And I think that's been the 30-year process here. Being able to say it without anger.
There's 5 minutes left for Q&A.
I know. I guess I've covered everything. Oh, yes, Melissa.
Hi there. Can you share with us how your relationship with God has changed and evolved over time and what it's like today?
My relationship with God waxes and wanes, so I don't know that it's been linear. And because I feel so vulnerable right now, I have to make an effort. But there's so much evidence in my life of where God has shown up, and things that I thought were the worst, that I didn't see the bigger picture. So I have to have faith, but I feel very challenged about faith right now. So I rely on other people's faith. So I think it's kind of like my relationship with food. Like, it's not perfect. It's not a perfect relationship, but you stay in relationship. For me, I know there's agnostics, the atheists in program, but for me, I need to have that faith. I need to nurture that and take a leap. It's a leap of faith, and it's a leap that makes my life better. So I choose to do it, and I'm in a particularly a stage where it's particularly important right now. So maybe that's good. Emily?
Hi, thank you so much for your share. It was amazing. I heard you talk a lot about like rest and self-care and productivity, and I identify. I was wondering kind of how you integrate that into your daily routine and if, or like what that looks like for you today.
Well, what it looks like today is that I do something and then I have to take a nap, which is, you know, ugh. But I actually, even before I got sick, I discovered that if you do a 20-minute meditation nap, whatever, it bought me like 5 more hours later in the day. So I had started doing that reluctantly because it feels like, and I don't want anybody to see it. I don't want anybody to know that. But like when I did it, it was really, really helpful. You know, I think unfortunately, fortunately, whatever, no judgment, the food is a piece of all of this for me. So one of the ways that I got into trouble, I think physically, and I'm just going to be honest, is that for 3 years, my lunch was a protein bar. Now that was abstinent because I wasn't binging. I wasn't throwing up. It was like a healthy protein bar. It was the sugar, none, all natural, whatever. But like, that was all, I'm not interested in lunch. It takes up too much time. I don't want to yammer. I just want to like, you know, and I think that that probably wasn't, no, it was not a healthy way to live. And so now maybe I'm a little bit paying the price for that, or I needed to be re-educated. Let's be kinder. So, you know, taking time for yourself and what keeps you your healthiest. And the irony being that this is like what I teach. This is what I do for a living, is tell people how to be happy and what you need, self-care and happiness. And you know, I'm the last person. So you have to make it a priority. And if you make it a priority in terms of like being of service, how am I best going to be of service in the world? Sometimes if my own instinct is, well, I don't care for me. Like I went to this one healer, right? And she said, if you keep this up, you could end up with a stroke because of the fire. I mean, you know, whatever. Okay, fine. But it hit me. I do not want a stroke. I do not want that for my kids. So even if I'm not willing to take care of myself for me, because I find it annoying, I know that I don't want that. And so I will take care of myself for the benefit of others. So I think even if you're feeling like, well, I don't care about, oh, please, it's a bunch of nonsense. If you know that it will affect the people that you love, or you volunteer, or your work, or whatever gives your life meaning, that's why you have to take care of yourself.